Case number 07-1532. Michael Charles Gorman, petitioner versus National Transportation Safety Board et al. Mr. Ellis for the petitioner, Mr. Berry for the respondents.
Let's wait till the courtroom is.
Good morning. My name is Stephen Ellis. I represent the petitioner Michael C. Gorman. In this matter, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This is a case about government overreaching. The FAA has many legitimate tools that it may use to promote aviation safety, but in doing so, it must use those tools in a way that is consistent with its own regulations and the statute. Here, the FAA acted in a manner that is contrary to both the applicable regulations and its statutory authority. Let me begin by addressing the question of the FAA's regulations. That provides the court with the most narrow and most straightforward ground to resolve the case. The regulation in dispute is 14 CFR 119.23, and specifically subdivision B2. It applies to airplanes, quote, having a passenger seat configuration of less than 20 seats. On its face, the regulation has two requirements. Number one, an airplane must have a passenger seat configuration. And number two, if it has a passenger seat configuration, the configuration must be of less than 20 seats.
Do you agree that we have to accept the FAA's interpretation of its own regulation unless it's clearly erroneous?
You
accept that, right?
Under the Christensen case, if the FAA's regulation is contrary to the unambiguous meaning of the regulation, this court is not bound by it, and of course the court is not bound if it's arbitrary and if it's an arbitrary and capricious interpretation of the regulation.
Well, how can this be unreasonable? The FAA says that 20 or less includes zero. And zero is a number.
Zero is a number, Your Honor, and zero is a number that's less than 20.
Right.
I'd rather have $20 in my bank account than $0 in my bank account.
Yeah.
But the regulation does not say that it applies to airplanes that have less than 20 seats. It says in airplanes having a passenger seat configuration of less than 20 seats.
So you could certainly read it the way you do, but the question we have to ask is whether the way the FAA reads it is unreasonable or clearly erroneous. I mean, you could have two readings of a regulation, and if the FAA's, the agency's, is not unreasonable, that ends the matter from our point of view.
Your Honor,
I found nothing in your brief that suggests that although you may disagree with the FAA's interpretation, you haven't indicated in any way that it's clearly erroneous.
Your Honor, the FAA's regulation here, I'm sorry, the FAA's interpretation of its regulation is unreasonable because it is inconsistent with the unambiguous meaning of the regulation, looking at three things, Your Honor.
Uh-huh.
Number one, the plain meaning of the regulation.
Yeah.
Number two, the history of the regulation. And number three, the structure of the FAA's regulations generally. These are all tools of construction that this court may use to determine whether the regulation has an unambiguous meaning. And if it does have an unambiguous meaning, this court need not defer to the FAA's interpretation.
We have to say that it unambiguously is the meaning that you attribute to it, right?
In
order for you to win, it has to be unambiguous.
Well, there's two arguments for us to win under the regulation. One is the argument that it is unambiguous considering the plain language, the history, the structure, and all of the traditional tools of construction that the court may use before even reaching the question of deference. And we also have arguments that we've presented about why, even if deference applies, and we don't believe there is any, we don't believe you get to deference in this case, and the FAA argued this case consistently as if there was no need for deference. But even if you do get to deference, the NTSB here erred in failing to consider, respond to, in a reasoned basis, the arguments we made to the
relevant
NTSB.
Relevant to what the NTSB decides, though, right? We held in the Garvey case that it's a pass-through. That is, that the NTSB, by statute, must defer to the FAA's reasonable readings, and we must defer to the FAA's reasonable readings. So whether the NTSB acted appropriately or not, our review here is directly of the FAA's argument, isn't it?
Your Honor, it is absolutely true that this court and the NTSB are bound by the FAA's reasonable interpretation of an ambiguous regulation.
But even if the NTSB's reason for thinking that the FAA's argument was reasonable is itself not reasonable, can you follow that?
Yes, I do.
We still have to uphold the FAA's decision if we think it's reasonable. We wouldn't send it back. If we think it's reasonable, we can't send it back to the NTSB and say, try again for another reason.
It's the NTSB's responsibility in the first instance. Are there two levels of deference here?
No, there is no deference from us to the NTSB on the question of the reasonableness of the FAA's regulation.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So we don't have to, whether the NTSB gives a bad argument or a good argument is irrelevant from our point of view.
I don't agree with that, Your Honor.
Why?
The court here is sitting reviewing the decision of the NTSB. The NTSB has an independent responsibility that it must discharge to act in a fashion that is not arbitrary and capricious as to Mr. Gorman or anyone else that comes before the NTSB. Here, the NTSB, we have independently argued, the NTSB acted arbitrarily and capriciously.
Let me be a little clear again, a little more clear about this. Assume, contrary to what you would like, that we think the FAA's reasoning is reasonable. Maybe not the best, maybe not perfect, but reasonable. But we also assume we agree with you that the NTSB didn't answer your arguments very well. Okay? What is the appropriate disposition here?
The appropriate disposition in that case, based on your assumptions,
yeah,
would be to remand to the NTSB to act in a fashion that's not arbitrary and capricious as to Mr. Gorman.
Any case that's ever held that is where the court says that the underlying agency's decision is reasonable. And I mean the FAA because of the specifics of 49 U.S.C. 44709D3, which requires the NTSB to defer, and our own opinion based on the Martin Supreme Court's case in Martin versus Oshrick, saying that we also must defer to the FAA. Is there any case in which a court has said, you know, the FAA was perfectly reasonable here, but we don't think the intermediate review of the NTSB was reasonable, and therefore we have to send it back?
I'm not aware of any case that holds that, Your Honor. I think in that situation, the appropriate remedy would be for this court not to reach the question about whether the FAA's interpretation is reasonable, when it can resolve the case on the more narrow ground that the NTSB acted arbitrarily and capriciously in failing to respond to a number of arguments that Mr. Gorman made to the board.
Any case ever do that?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but again, I don't think that the court would need to reach out and decide the ultimate question.
I mean, there are a lot of these cases it's true under the Mine Act, it's true under the FAA Act, where you have these dual systems of adjudication and enforcement. Are there any cases in which the court says we're not going to reach the reasonableness of the agency's decision because the intermediate review body acted arbitrarily? This is also true under Oshrick. All these statutes have the same basic structure, and I, with which I'm pretty familiar, having written cases in all these areas. And I don't know of anywhere a court has said that we're not going to decide whether the agency's policy is reasonable because the appellate body within the agency wasn't reasonable.
Your Honor, in direct answer to your question, I'm not aware of whether there are or are not such cases. It's not something that I'm prepared to say one way or another whether are such cases. I'd be happy.
Let me take you back to your argument that this regulation is clear and unambiguous.
Yes, Your Honor.
The title includes the phrase cargo operations, right?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
Well, what do you think about that?
Well,
isn't that exactly what your client has, cargo operations?
No, Your Honor, and I know that seems like a strange answer.
Yes, it does.
The difference is that there is an understanding in the aviation community.
I assume your cargo planes don't have seat configurations, right?
There's a distinction in the aviation industry between cargo and all cargo, and that's the difference. It's commonplace for planes to carry passengers and cargo.
Yeah.
And then in that situation, of course, plane.
But remember now, your argument is that this regulation is unambiguous.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it says cargo operations.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're saying, there's two kinds of cargo operations, and we're not one of them, right? But that's. It's perfectly.
Well, the other part of the answer, Your Honor, is that that's in the heading, and what really matters here is the text of the statute.
Why is that?
I don't think that's the case.
It's not a statute. I'm sorry, Judge Taylor.
This is just a regulation. We're trying to figure out whether the agency's interpretation of the regulation is reasonable or not. And I can't imagine why we wouldn't also look at the title.
The reasoning behind that is that it's the text of the statute is the governing law. It is the act of the agency which makes the law.
You mean the
regulation? Wait, I'm sorry. Did I say statute? Excuse me. I meant regulation. Yeah. I'm sorry. It is the text of the regulation that imposes obligations. I don't believe that I've ever seen
a case that says that. Do you know a case that says that when we're trying to figure out whether an agency's interpretation is reasonable or not, we can't look at the title?
We cited the cases that talked about titles, I believe, in the statutory context.
Actually, we do look at titles in the statutory context when it helps to interpret the statute.
When a statute's ambiguous,
yeah.
But you would never use the title of a statute, for example, to contradict, except in perhaps an extraordinary situation,
to contradict the plain text. Do you know of a case that applies that to regulations?
I do not, Your Honor, but let me just make one additional point.
Right.
If there were a challenge under the APA to a rule that's made, and a party were to say, I don't have any problem with the text of that regulation, but boy, I don't like the title. I think that challenge would be respectfully laughed out of court. What matters in terms of creating substantive responsibilities that regulated entities must follow is the text of the statute. And here, not only the text, but as we pointed out in our brief, there's the history of the regulation, the changes that the FAA made, and the structure of the regulation. The term passenger seat configuration is used throughout the FAA's own regulations in a context that clearly assumes the existence of at least one seat. It assumes that there must be a passenger seat configuration. You don't need emergency exit signs, for example, on a all-cargo airplane. And as we pointed out, and I do want to clarify one thing in our brief, there was a typo in our brief, that there is one point in 2003 where the FAA was considering the application and extension of its regulations regarding collision avoidance systems. And the FAA wanted to extend that to some all-cargo airplanes. And the FAA itself said, and this is in 2003, the current rules, the existing rules that then existed in 2003.
Sorry, you said there's a typo.
Yes, and it's in a footnote in our brief. We cited.
What page are you? Just so I don't rely on it later again.
I believe it's footnote 4. It is footnote 4 on page 27. We cited 60 Fed Reg. It should have been 68, volume 68 of the Federal Register. The remainder of the site is correct. It's 68 Fed Reg 15884 in 2003. The FAA itself said the then existing rules, the current rules, are based on passenger seating configuration and therefore exclude all cargo airplanes. This was the understanding of the FAA consistently until this case.
Judge Taylor, are you finished?
Yeah.
Okay, I just have one more question for you. This is on the waiver question. I understand your first argument and why it's not waived. That is the argument that it's beyond statutory authority and therefore you couldn't have raised it below. Your second argument, as you put it in your brief, is that the FAA erroneously applied Part 119, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because your client is not a commercial operator. That doesn't sound like a jurisdictional argument. That just sounds like you're saying that it's an erroneous application. That is, the agency wrongly concluded that your client is a commercial operator. And that sounds like the kind of argument you could have made below. I understand why you couldn't have made the other one, but I don't understand why that one couldn't have been made below.
Your Honor, I think that particular argument has as both an application and a jurisdictional element to it. The foundational basis for the FAA to act under this regulation is the definition of air commerce, its own definition of air commerce, and the definition of air commerce in the statute. And so it does have a jurisdictional element.
But you could have argued, I mean, the wording, in this part you're not arguing that there's something unconstitutional or outside of the jurisdiction with respect to the regulation. You're just saying that it's erroneously applied and that they, you know, made a mistake and they shouldn't have made that mistake. And that seems like the very typical thing you would argue first before the agency.
Your Honor, I think it does have, in addition to that basis, it does, though, also have a statutory basis. It does relate to whether the FAA was properly reaching into an area that had jurisdiction under the statute to reach into.
That's your first argument.
The statutory argument about 44701 and 44702.
Yes.
Is that, and that, that the, it also applies to the regulatory, the argument about the application of air commerce under the regulations.
It's not an additional, but that, to the extent there's an additional argument about erroneous application, that could have been made below. But you think it's so tied in with the other? Is that what you're saying?
thank you. That is, they are, they're separate and distinct arguments. They stand and fall separately from each other, but they are linked together in that there is, a question of the agency's power to even reach, given the regulatory and statutory structure, to reach Mr. Gorman's operations.
Are you done?
Yes.
Yeah. I have a question about your statutory argument. Is it your view that the agency has no authority at all to issue safety standards for non-common carriers? Is that your position?
No, Your Honor.
What is it?
The position is that the FAA can regulate Mr. Gorman's operations and certainly does regulate conceitedly under Part 91, which applies to all aircraft and all pilots. What is improper here was the agency did not have the authority to regulate Mr. Gorman's operations through requiring an operating certificate. And that is because 44702 sets forth the
type. What about 701?
44701 is a general, very broad grant of authority.
Right.
And we cite a number of cases that explain and hold that where there is a very general, broad grant of authority, as there is to almost all agencies, but there's another provision that Congress sets forth which is more specific and applies, that the limitations in the more specific provision take precedence over the broad general authority given to agencies.
Well, does 701 apply to this situation?
701...
It doesn't, right? That's your position. They can't regulate under 44701.
The FAA cannot regulate in this manner under 44701.
So 44701 doesn't cover this situation, but it has a general authority under 44701 to issue safety standards, doesn't
it? Let me try to express it this way, and I hope this gets at your question, Your Honor. If 44702 did not exist, this would be a different case with regard to our statutory authority. If you just look at 44701 on its face, I agree that it would appear that the court has jurisdiction, I'm sorry, that the agency could, had statutory authority to require the type of certificate that is at issue here. But 44702 also exists and must be harmonized with 44701.
Well, doesn't that just mean that when they proceed under when something's covered by 702, they have to follow the provisions of 702. But if it isn't, as is this case, then they have the generic provisions of 44701 to follow.
Well, that would mean...
So they're perfectly consistent.
That would mean, essentially, Your Honor, that the provisions of 44702 are, I guess, simply illustrative.
No, not at all. It means that if they're regulating something under, like, I'll give you an example. I mean, if it issues a certificate under 702, then it has to do the things that 702 require it to do. It can't skip them by regulating under 44701. But if it isn't covered by 44702, then the provisions of 44701 give it the authority it needs. In other words, it can't use its general authority to override the specifics of 702, but if it isn't covered by 702, then it has the general 701 authority. Right?
I understand your point, Your Honor, and the reason that I don't think that principle applies here is that if you look at 44702, you'll see that it does not have, it's not a, standing alone, a extensive set of requirements that must be, that the Congress has not imposed an extensive set of requirements that must be imposed in order for the FAA to issue these types of certificates. Mm-hmm. Is reading it in the context of the statute, it is a grant of authority to the types of certificates that the agency may issue.
But it doesn't say only. It just says they may issue these. If Congress wanted to say these are the only kinds, or that it's not under some safety circumstances, something else couldn't be done, it could have said that. It didn't say that.
It did not say that, but I think in the context here, it's clear that it's a grant of authority to issue these types of certificates. It does not say these types and no others. But if you look again at the history of this particular provision, 44702, you will see that over time it's been amended. Congress has added certification authority to the FAA.
Right, and the FAA must now follow those specific provisions with respect to those kinds of certificates. Well, with respect to certificates that aren't covered by that, it still has a generic 44701 authority.
Again, Your Honor, 44702 is not an extensive cataloging of requirements. It is mm-hmm. a grant of authority of types of certificates that the FAA
no,
may
no,
issue.
No, it's not. I mean, take, for example, 705, air carrier certificates. I mean, there's a long list of requirements here. Air carrier certificates have to say, among other things, where you can fly to and from, right? So if the agency issues an air carrier certificate under, it can't use its 701 authority to avoid requiring where the carrier to say where it's flying to and from. It has to follow those provisions.
Well, 705 does include some substantive provisions. It's not
well the whole statute.
It's not very extensive. I mean, it's fairly straightforward. It simply requires
but the section goes on covers all the certificates.
There are other sections that are
that are quite detailed.
I'm sorry?
That are quite detailed, right?
Yes, some of them are certainly detailed, some are not. The other point that regarding 44702 is I think it's significant that Congress has the most recent amendment to 44702 was made effective, it was passed several years ago and it's made effective in 2010. The Congress believes that 44702 is an important provision, a well-tended provision, carefully crafted. To read 44702 to authorize the FAA to issue whatever certificates it wants, or to read 44701 to give the FAA authority to issue whatever certificates it wants, does not seem, to me at least, to be consistent with the way Congress has from time to time amended 44702.
All right, you're way over your time, so.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Mr. Berry.
May it please the court. I'd like to first address Mr. Gorman's statutory argument since that was the last that was discussed here. The FAA actually has the statutory authority to issue certificates beyond those set forth in 44702A. Mr. Gorman focuses primarily on 44702A, that specific provision. However, even if you look at that provision, there's nothing limiting the FAA's authority to issue certificates. The title to that section, or the caption, states general authority and applications. It doesn't say sole authority. Furthermore, the first sentence, as Judge Garland stated, provides that the administrator of the FAA may issue certificates. It doesn't say may only issue these certificates. 4472B also underscores the fact that the agency has the authority to issue certificates under 44701A. Under the consideration section of 44702B, the Congress provided, when issuing a certificate under this chapter, it didn't say section, but chapter 447. I think the most significant point I'd like to make with respect to the statutory argument is that 49 U.S.C. section 44711 clearly states that the agency can issue certificates under 44701A. Yes, it's
a little slower there. 4470 what?
44711A5.
Is that in the?
I did not cite that in my opening brief.
Is it in the back of either the red brief or the blue brief?
No, Your Honor. I did not cite this provision in my opening brief.
Or your reply brief?
I didn't file a reply brief.
Oh, yeah. Right, of course. Okay. So, in other words, I can't find it by looking in the briefs.
Okay.
Right, is that right?
So could you
read it? 44711?
Well, the specific site is 49 U.S.C. section 44711A5. It's a prohibitions section. And that specific provision provides that it prohibits persons from, quote, operating aircraft in air commerce in violation of a certificate issued under section 44701A. Moreover, the plain language of 44701A5 gives the agency the broad authority to issue certificates, including operator certificates. And the agency's reading of this provision is consistent with the Second Circuit's decision in FAA versus Landy. The very same argument was made in Landy that the FAA did not have the authority to require operating certificates or to issue those certificates. However, the Second Circuit rejected that argument, concluding that the agency's broad statutory authority allows it to issue operating certificates and to require the holding of such certificates.
This is an unimportant point, I'm sure, but was his airman certificate also pulled?
What happened in this case was he surrendered he had an air carrier certificate back in 2003. However, in 2005, he surrendered that certificate to the FAA based on his belief that he could conduct his operations under the baseline safety regulations set forth in Part 91.
You at least need an airman certificate.
He had an airman certificate.
Airman certificate is the same as a pilot license, or is it something?
Yes, yes. In this, for the purpose of this case, his airman certificate, which was, I believe, a commercial pilot certificate, is the same as basically a pilot's license. And the agency revoked that because of his 20 flights after the agency.
It's revoked because he doesn't have the other certificate. In other words, the case can't be resolved on the ground that 44702 obviously expressly refers to airman certificates.
That's correct. In fact,
so it can't be, because the reason that one was pulled was because he didn't have the other one.
Well, again, he surrendered his air carrier certificate, and the reason the other was pulled was because he needed that other certificate to conduct those operations, and because he didn't have that certificate, he was in violation of provisions set forth in 119. However, even in the absence of that certificate, even if he didn't have that certificate and still conducted those operations, he would still be in violation of provisions relating to commercial operations, such as the need to undergo competency checks. The provisions essentially that are set forth in the emergency order of revocation. So that's why the agency revoked his certificate, because he continued to conduct these operations.
Well, the agency revoked the only certificate he had, right? The airman certificate.
Well, he had a medical certificate too, but the agency, insofar as his operating certificate is concerned, the agency, that was the only certificate that the agency revoked. He surrendered his air carrier certificate.
Right. At the time of the revocation, that's the only certificate he had.
That, yes, in a medical certificate, right, to my knowledge. Furthermore, I think the statutory construction and rule that should apply in this case is that statutes must be read to ensure that they're given the maximum possible effect. And giving the maximum possible effect to sections 44701, 702, and 711, the FAA clearly has the authority to issue operating certificates. Now, addressing Mr. Gorman's contention that his operations didn't fall within 91.23b, his argument, contrary to his contention, ignores the design, purpose, and plain language of Part 119. All operators must comply with baseline safety rules, which are set forth in Part 91. Even air carriers must comply with Part 91. But in addition to complying or having to comply with Part 91, commercial operators also have to comply with add-on safety requirements. And these are mapped out in Part 119. In fact, the major purpose of Part 119 is to capture commercial activity involving the operation of aircraft and to inform those operators of those aircraft which additional safety rules are applicable to their operation. The agency wrote an applicability section which captured Mr. Gorman's operation. In other words, Part 119 is applicable to air carriers, which he was not, but also to commercial operator activities. He was a commercial operator. His operations didn't fit within any of the exceptions to Part 119. So the next question was, which add-on safety rules applied to him? The requirements that applied to him are set forth in 119.23, because if you look at the heading, 119.23 tells commercial operators like Mr. Gorman engaged in passenger carrying operations, cargo operations, or both when common carriage is not involved, which set of additional safety rules apply in Part 119 and in Part 119.23. 119.23a didn't apply to him because his aircraft were too small to fit within that provision. However, he fit within the provision of 119.23b. He engaged in non-common or private carriage, which he admitted in his complaint. He did it for compensation or hire. He had a payload capacity of less than 6,000 pounds. And he also operated airplanes with a passenger seat configuration of less than 20 seats. Now, his argument noticeably focuses on that small phrase. It ignores the fact that that small phrase fits within a broad regulatory structure. 119.23 doesn't excuse all cargo operations from the applicability of additional safety rules when such operators have configured their aircraft to have zero passenger seats. What 119.23 does is tell a commercial operator which additional safety rules apply to that operation. So by removing his passenger seats, Mr. Gorman configured his aircraft to have a passenger seat configuration of less than 20 seats. Zero is less than 20. In addition, to the extent that there is any confusion with respect to that language, and the administrator submits that they're not, one needs only look at the heading, which, as Judge Tatel, I think, indicated, clearly suggests that this regulation applies to cargo-only operations, such as the type of operation that Mr. Gorman engaged in. Furthermore, accepting Mr. Gorman's argument, I think, would produce absurd results. It would create a new class of cargo-only operators for compensation or hire in small aircraft that would not be subject to the additional safety rules, which the agency clearly intends or intended by implementing Part 119 and having Parts 135, or at least Part 135. But furthermore, Mr. Gorman's argument would suggest that operators who have one passenger seat, even cargo operators that only have one passenger seat aboard their aircraft, would be captured by this particular provision, 119.23b. However, if that operator happened to remove that seat and carried the same goods, suddenly that operator wouldn't be captured under 119.23b. So his argument produces absurd results.
But what about his argument that there are other provisions of the regulation that use the same regulations that use the same phrase that couldn't possibly be meant to apply where there's no passengers at all, like the seatbelt, the provision, and the exit?
Right.
What's the answer to that?
The use of the term either passenger seat configuration or passenger seating configuration in other FARs or Federal Aviation Regulations. Must be taken in the context of that, must be understood in the context of those regulations. Every single one of the regulations that Mr. Gorman cites to support his reading of passenger seat configuration clearly indicate that passenger seats were understood as a part of that regulation. And I might add that his understanding of the Federal Register provision that he relies on is incorrect, and the circumstances behind that Federal Register provision, which involved requiring cargo operators to have a collision avoidance system aboard their aircraft, came about because Congress told the FAA to require cargo operators to have TCAS in large planes, collision avoidance systems. Just like passenger carrying aircraft had them prior to, or presently have them right now. So the FAA was responding to Congress in requiring commercial operator or all cargo operations to have TCAS. And so the language that Mr. Gorman relies on really indicates that the TCAS rules excluded all cargo operations because they only related to, or they only apply to, passenger seating aircraft. So that's the circumstance of that particular site right there. Again, all these sites he puts in his brief have to be taken in the context that they were intended. For these reasons, the agency requests that the court affirm the NTSB's decision. Thank you.
All right. Why don't you take 1 minute?
In your 1 minute, I know you. This is unfair surprise because it surprised me as well. But this section 44.711, which through the miracle of Westlaw I now have on my screen, seems like a pretty good argument that Congress does understand that certificates can be issued under 44.701A. Do you have an immediate response to that?
Your Honor, I apologize. I do not have a response to that. The miracle of Westlaw doesn't apply to counsel table. Yeah. I would be happy if the court would like to look at that and file a supplemental brief, but I, sitting here, standing here today, I do not have a...
Sorry, Judge Henderson, if we could ask him to file something by the end of the day, that would be, or the end of tomorrow.
If I could have it to the end of tomorrow, I'm traveling, I'm resident in our Los Angeles office, I'm traveling back today.
Because what it says is a person may not operate aircraft in air commerce. I appreciate there's the air commerce problem, but that's a different question. In violation of a regulation prescribed or certificate issued under Section 44.701A. So that seems like Congress is contemplating certificates under that section.
Yeah, I'm shooting in the dark here, Your Honor, so I apologize.
I have.
Yes.
All right. Well, then by the end of tomorrow, file whatever you want to file.
Your Honor,
as far as your interpretation.
Thank you, and I'm pleased to do that. Just in logistics.
Go ahead.
Just in logistics of filing that, I'm in our Los Angeles office. May I FedEx it to the court tomorrow so it will be received the following morning? Would that be sufficient, or would it be better to fax? I don't know that I can physically get it to the court tomorrow, a signed brief.
All right, if you FedEx it, that'll be sufficient.
Thank you.
I have a follow-up question about my question to you about the statutory authority of the agency to issue safety standards for non-common carriers. When I asked you that question, you said yes, but it had to be done under 702. And I thought your argument was that 702 didn't cover non-common carriers.
I may have misspoken, Your Honor.
No?
And if I did, I apologize. The FAA has the power to issue safety regulations that govern non-common carriers.
And under what authority?
That would be under the authority under 44701. But what it may not...
701?
What it may not do is require an operating certificate that is other than the ones that are listed in 44702. Under Part 91.
Does 702 cover operating certificates for non-common carriers?
Yes. For non-common carriers. No, it covers.
Well, then I don't understand your argument of how the agency could regulate this particular carrier.
The agency can regulate under Part 91. The general provision that applies to all aircraft and all pilots, and can impose safety requirements, and has in fact imposed extensive safety requirements that apply to all pilots and all aircraft. It may regulate Mr. Gorman's operations under Part 91 generally. It could conceivably create special regulations under Part 91 that would apply to non-common carriers. What it can't do is essentially what it tried to do here. The agency is putting a square peg in a round hole. And it's interesting. If you look on page, just one point on this, on page 177 of the Joint Appendix, there's an example of a Part 135 certificate. And it says in big letters on top, air carrier certificate. Air carrier is a term of art. It's defined in the statute. As Mr. Berry said in his brief, and as he said today, and as everyone agrees, Mr. Gorman was not an air carrier. Asking him to have an air carrier certificate issued under Part 135 is putting a square peg in a round hole. He is not an air carrier under the definition of air carrier and a series of definitions that we lay out in our brief to explain the ultimate point is because he does not engage in common carriage, he does not meet the statutory definition of an air carrier. So to require him to have an air carrier certificate is beyond the authority of the FAA and is, frankly, meaningless.
All right. Your time's up.
Thank you, Your Honors.